you, Comrade Chairman, comrades and friends. This, as you know, is the final lecture in the series, and I also want to make it the concluding lecture in the series, and that I want to try to pull a few of the points together. During the course of it, we have discussed history, and we have discussed the dialectical principle. And such discussion should enable us to be philosophically equipped to understand the past and perceive the historically possible options for the future. We have discussed the origins of religion, and this has shown us how man made gods and how scientific thought must banish such imaginary beings from our rational consciousness. We have examined the relationship between capitalism and democracy, and we've seen from the great Chartist struggles of the last century that a democratic society without removing capitalism is like an omelette without cracking eggs. You simply cannot produce one. We've discussed morality and concluded that socialism is not necessary because it is good, but it is good because it is necessary. And we've examined the vision of socialism, pointing out that what is proposed by socialists is not a radical rearrangement of capitalism, but a new social system, quite unlike the one which we experience every day. A great step forward in the development of human interaction. And in this lecture, I want to discuss that step forward and what it entails, the revolution. To favour socialist transformation without revolution is like favouring steak and chips without favouring killing cows. You cannot create a socialist society without a fundamental upheaval and destruction of the system which exists at the moment. But there are some people who are very much more in favour of the idea of socialism as a made-to-measure, ready-to-live-in society than they are in favour of revolution. We've had revolutions before, they say, and the results weren't very nice. They refer us to the French Revolution of 1789 and the 1848 upheavals all over Europe. They remind us of barricades and bloodshed and corpses and reigns of terror. And they say this is what revolution produces. But these were not socialist revolutions, we tell them. These were capitalist affairs where one privileged minority fought against another privileged minority for control of the state machine, using the working class as a pawn in the game. Well, what about the Russian Revolution, say the anti-revolutionaries? That was supposed to be socialist. And look at the consequences of it in terms of human misery. Well, no socialist revolutionary would dispute for a moment that these consequences do exist. The so-called socialism of Russia and its empire manifests a form of dictatorial state capitalism which oppresses millions of people, locks them in prisons, throws them out of work, puts them in armies, involves them in wars, all of the hateful symptoms of an oppressive and exploitative society. And to defend that state is to defend capitalism. And to do so in the name of socialism is a distortion of the worst kind. It is to link together two fundamentally opposite conceptions, dictatorship and socialism. Now, opponents of revolution, who are usually quite glad to defend oppression in its openly capitalist form, will be pleased to hear that revolutionary socialists oppose the Russian tyranny. We oppose it no less than the Tory party, than the SDP, than President Reagan. the only difference perhaps between us is that we don't do multi-million dollar trade with them and they do. But opposition to this is not sufficient. To come up with a recipe for a cake which poisons everyone who tastes it is a pretty serious mistake to make. And to simply oppose the poisonous cake is to do nothing at all. To understand what is wrong with the recipe, which in the case of the Russian Revolution was the Bolshevik recipe, is to go beyond effects and symptoms and to start looking at causes. Why did it end up like that? Now, unfortunately, the vast majority of parties and groups and sects and individuals who call themselves revolutionary socialists have not rejected the Bolshevik recipe. They cling on to it in the belief, quite mistaken, that Leninism equals socialist revolution. And if you're not a Leninist, if you are not a Bolshevik, if you do not want to reenact the events of Petrograd and Moscow of October 1917, then you cease to have any entitlement to the label of revolutionary. Well, this evening I want to look at the non-Bolshevik, indeed the anti-Bolshevik, approach to revolution. And in doing so, I'll concentrate on three factors. Firstly, Marx's theory and experience in relation to working class revolution. Secondly, Julius Martov's critique of Blanquism as opposed to Lenin's adoption of Blanquist ideas. And thirdly, the Russian Revolution as an exercise in Blanquist strategy and as a defeat for socialist principles. Now, I'll say at the outset that the need for brevity will require me to stick to the essential points. You'll be able to find the non-essential points in most of the books written about Leninism. Marx's earliest formulation of revolutionary tactics was profoundly influenced by the experience of the French Revolution at the end of the 18th century. This was the event which proved to Marx and to other revolutionary thinkers the strength of a mass of people. For the first time in European politics, it demonstrated that a crowd of people united, however vaguely, by a common aim, could do something. They could get rid of a king. They could open up prisons. They could, to some extent, direct history. Now, the name which was associated with conspiratorial revolutionary organisation in France, particularly in the 1840s, was Auguste Blanqui. He argued, and that name is B-L-A-N-Q-U-I, he argued that an enlightened revolutionary vanguard, a leadership, could overthrow the coercive state by means of violent insurrection and that they could establish communism on behalf of the exploited class, with the emphasis on behalf of, to do it for them. Now, Marx began by conceiving revolution in these conspiratorial terms. How else, Marx argued, could the semi-feudal autocracies of Europe in his day be destroyed except by small groups of people gathering together, getting arms and taking on the forces of the state? And Marx and Engels, in their early thinking about revolution, thought in these violent insurrectionary terms of street battles, barricades, people's armies, and so on. Now, it's unfortunate that for most people who call themselves Marxists, they never got any further than that. Marx and Engels did. And one should not ignore the fact that Marx was writing at a time when the capitalist class was still struggling with the feudal aristocracy for control of the state, when the workers, in whose interests socialism would be, were still almost entirely excluded from voting or from having any real influence on political power. And that is why, in the Communist Manifesto, written by Marx and Engels and published in 1848, it stated that the first step of the socialist revolution, before anything else, is, and I quote, to raise the proletariat to the position of a ruling class, to win the battle for democracy. Now, winning the battle for democracy meant being in a position to control political power. It meant having access to the state, having access to government, local and national, to the armed forces, to the law courts, having some working class accessibility to these areas of power. And once the workers could control political power, Marx argued that they would control it in their own class interests. In other words, they would use this democracy which would have been gained in order to dispossess the minority capitalist class, who within a democratic constitution could never outvote the working class majority, and then establish socialism. And it was this ascendancy of the exploited majority to political power which is spoken about in Clause 6 of the Declaration of Principles of the SPGB. It's this ascendancy to democratic control which Marx summed up by the term, which has been so abused and distorted and confused, the dictatorship of the proletariat. Now, in his book, Democracy or Dictatorship, Karl Kautsky, when he was involved in a lengthy and very stimulating polemic with Lenin, Kautsky wrote that, I quote, at the beginning of their activity, Marx and Engels were greatly influenced by Blanquism. The dictatorship of the proletariat to which they aspired in their first writings still showed some Blanquist features. Now, I would argue that Marx and Engels only accepted Blanquism and only accepted the old French revolutionary Jacobin idea prior to their full understanding of the materialist conception of history. It was at the point when Marx and Engels got to grips with the laws of historical motion, with the materialist conception of history, that they threw out the old ideas of conspiracy as advanced by Auguste Blanqui. Because when it comes to it, the belief that a minority can manipulate history by the strength of conviction is in complete opposition to the materialist recognition that socialism is an impossibility unless the conditions giving rise to it, including mass working class political consciousness, unless they exist. Now, the proof of this was tragically demonstrated to Marx and his whole generation in 1871, when the war-weary workers of Paris declared themselves autonomous, threw aside their government, and established the Commune of Paris. Now, amongst those who set up the Commune, and that's the subject of a quite independent lecture, I can't do justice to the Paris Commune here tonight, although it's a very, very important subject. But amongst those who set it up in 1871 were workers, many of whom were influenced by Blanqui, who genuinely wanted socialist revolution and saw it as the only alternative. Consider, for example, a statement which is very rarely quoted for reasons that you'll see when you hear it, because it's frankly one of the people who took part in the Commune who had a lot more understanding than many of the others. The words written by Bouy written in a newspaper called Le Drapeau in March 1871. He says, "Yes, for 82 years we have struggled for nothing. We have taken the wrong route and have brought ourselves to a disaster. How ridiculous to have smashed the power of kings without destroying monarchy, to have abolished privileges without eliminating privileged classes, removing symbols while leaving intact the reality they represented. We have foolishly rid ourselves of the men and retained the institutions. Let's do the job properly this time. Socialism, citizens, socialism. Let's be socialists at last. That's it. Let's change the foundations of the social order. Let's build a new world. Let's sow the seeds of freedom. Let's emancipate labour. Let's establish equality. War upon privilege. War upon exploitation. War upon ignorance, misery and servitude. Instead of removing the thorns of the brambles, workers, remove the roots." Now that was a very interesting statement made at the time of the Commune. But these kind of powerful sentiments which inspired those heroic men and women who took part in the Paris Commune, they gave rise to a movement of workers who tried to organise democratically. They tried to organise without leaders, but with delegates who had to report back, and if they weren't doing their job properly, they were out. With tribunals, so that if anyone did anything against the democratic will, a popular tribunal would hear the case and see what was going to happen, so that everything was organised as democratically as could be expected in that kind of a makeshift communistic setup. Now, as most of you will know, the Commune was crushed by the forces of capital. The French army went in what is arguably one of the most destructive and brutal attacks on working class self-organisation of all time. And 30,000 communards were killed within a very short time. Hundreds of thousands were imprisoned. It was one of the greatest setbacks to the working class movement in Europe ever experienced. And the attempt to create an island of socialism where conditions could not allow it to exist, ended in failure. Heroic failure, but failure is no more pleasant because it's heroic. Now, Marx understood the reason for the Commune's defeat. And he made this clear in a letter to a Dutch correspondent in February 1881. This Dutch so-called socialist had written to Marx saying, "Why shouldn't socialists take part in capitalist governments?" Marx said, "You can't create a bit of socialism within a capitalist environment." And he went on to say, "Perhaps you will refer me to the Paris Commune, but apart from the fact that this was merely the rising of a city under exceptional conditions, the majority of the Commune was in no way socialist, nor could it be. With a modicum of common sense, however, it could have reached a compromise with Versailles useful to the whole mass of the people, the only thing that could be reached at that time." In other words, Marx understood by the 1880s that socialist revolution involved necessary historical prerequisites which must exist, and the absence of which could only allow the possibility of compromise. Now, after the Commune, in 1874, Blanqui and 32 of his comrades formed an organisation called the Revolutionary Commune Group. These called themselves the refugees from the Commune because they'd been moved from outside of Paris. And they aimed to continue the tradition of the commune by means of underground, undemocratic means. Now, Engels, Marx's collaborator, replied to this declaration of principles written by the 33 members of the Revolutionary Commune Group. And Engels's reply, not frequently quoted in fact, was directly repudiating the conspiratorial arguments of Blanqui's group. Engels was saying, you've got to take account of history. You've got to look at capitalism as it is. And for that reason, I'm going to ask Edwin to quote from Engels' reply at some length.
The Blanquists were not actually founded by Blanqui. Only a few of the 33 signatories have ever spoken to Blanqui. They are so named because they wish to act in accordance with his spirit and tradition. Blanqui is essentially a political revolutionary and is a socialist only emotional, feeling for the sufferings of the masses. He has no socialist theory, nor has he any definite practical proposals for social relief. In his political activity, he has been essentially a man of action, believing that a small, well-organized minority launching a revolutionary attack at the correct moment can, by a few early successes, sweep the mass of the people along with it, and thus accomplish a successful revolution. Blanqui's conception of revolution as an attack by a small revolutionary minority logically entails the necessity of dictatorship in the event of victory. A dictatorship, it must be understood, not of the whole revolutionary class, the proletariat, but of just those few who launched the attack, and who are themselves already subject to the dictatorship of one or a few individuals. Our London Blanquists also believe in the principle that revolutions do not make themselves, but are made. That revolutions are made by a comparatively small minority, and according to a previously designed plan. And finally, that the moment is always ripe for action. Of course, such principles expose one defencelessly to all the self-deceptions to which political refugees are prone, and cause one to plunge from one foolish act to another. The refugee wants above all to act Blanqui, the man of action. But good intentions can accomplish little here. Not everyone possesses Blanqui's revolutionary instinct and his capacity for swift decision. If anything is certain, it is that the Paris proletariat needs a considerable period of rest to regain its strength after the exhausting war, the starving out of Paris, and above all, the frightful bloodletting of May 1871, and that every premature attempt to rise again can only result in another, more frightful defeat. Communists are communists because they see past all intermediate stations and compromises created not by themselves, but by historical evolution, to their ultimate goal, which is the abolition of classes, the building of a society where private property of land and of the means of production will no longer exist. The 33 are communists because they imagine all will be settled as soon as they have the goodness to leap over the intermediate stations and compromises, and that when the attack is launched in the course of the next few days, as it is certain to be, and they take over the helm, then communism can be introduced the very next day. If that is not immediately possible, then they are not communists. What childish naivety to adduce impatience as a theoretically convincing reason. In every revolution, a host of foolish acts occur, just as at any other time, and when one eventually finds time for criticism, one is forced to come to this conclusion. We have done much that we should not have done, and we have left undone much that we should have done, and that is why things went wrong. But what a want of criticism to declare the commune to be sacred and infallible, and to assert that every house which was burned down, and every scapegoat who was shot, received their just deserts, absolutely, down to the dot on the eyes. Is not this the same as claiming that during the week of blood in May, the people shot precisely those persons who needed to be shot, and no others? Is it not the same as claiming that in the first French Revolution, every head met the fate it deserved? First the heads of those guillotined by Robespierre, and then the head of Robespierre himself. Such are the juvenilities basically when intention people fall into, when they give free rein to their desire to appear shocking.
So that's what Engels had to say about people who attempted to continue this hopeless, though heroic, attempt at setting up an island of socialism. And in the light of this, it is perhaps understandable that in 1917, when news of the Bolshevik victory in Russia was received in Britain by the Socialist Party of Great Britain, amongst others, Jack Fitzgerald wrote in the Socialist Standard that what had happened was likely to be just another Paris Commune. It was the immediate connection that was made. The Blanquists in the Russia of 1917 were, of course, the Bolsheviks. Because for all of his claims to be a Marxist and a materialist, Lenin was in fact an incorrigible philosophical idealist who believed that minority will could smash down the barriers which history imposes. For Lenin, the dictatorship of the proletariat meant the monopoly of political power by a vanguard party apparently acting on behalf of the working class, exactly the same as Blanqui and his fellow conspirators in France. Lenin argued that the dictatorship of one man was not even incompatible with Soviet democracy. He actually wrote this. He argued that a leadership who were more enlightened, taking control of society, were infinitely more progressive than a reactionary czarist autocracy, which was also only a minority imposing itself on the majority. Now, it is interesting to bring in the writings of Martov to consider what Martov had to say about this connection which Lenin makes between democracy and dictatorship as being in some ways dialectically reconcilable when he speaks about this term in his major pamphlet, The State and the Socialist Revolution.
The completely democratic constitution of the Paris Commune, based on universal suffrage, on the immediate recall of every office holder by the simple decision of his electors, on the suppression of bureaucracy and the armed force as opposed to the people, on the electiveness of all offices, that is what constitutes, according to Marx, the essence of the dictatorship of the proletariat. He never thinks of opposing such a dictatorship of democracy. Already in 1847, in his first draft of the Communist Manifesto, Engels wrote, "The proletarian revolution will establish first of all the democratic administration of the state and will thus install, directly or indirectly, the political domination of the proletariat. Directly in England, where the proletariat forms the majority of the population. Indirectly in France and in Germany, where the majority of the population is not composed only of proletarians, but also of small peasants and small bourgeois, who are only now beginning to pass into the proletariat, and whose political interests fall more and more under the influence of the proletariat. The first step in the revolution by the working class, declares the manifesto, is to raise the proletariat to the position of a ruling class, to win the battle of democracy. Between the elevation of the proletariat to the position of a ruling class and the conquest of democracy, Marx and Engels put an equal sign. They understood the application of this political power by the proletariat only in the forms of a total democracy. In the measure that Marx and Engels became convinced that the socialist revolution could only be accomplished with the support of the majority of the population, accepting knowingly the positive programme of socialism, so the conception of a class dictatorship lost its Jacobin content.
Well, I'm not going to spend a great deal of time this evening again because time doesn't permit, to go into the Blanquist political characteristics of Lenin's thinking. Although I would say that for those of you who want to read about that, there's an article about it in next month's Socialist Standard. But it is something which I do want to look at, and far less often discussed, the Menshevik position in 1917. Now, it's very much harder to talk about what the Mensheviks stood for than it is to speak about what the Bolsheviks stood for, because the Menshevik position was a very much less centralised one. It wasn't dominated by a leadership, there were far more factions and currents, and it was a freer intellectual environment. We can, however, speak about, and this is what I want to concentrate on, the position of the most prominent and the intellectually most advanced Menshevik, Martov, who, as an historical materialist, rejected the Bolshevik adventure. Now, Martov argued, as Marx did, in relation to the Paris Commune, when the French workers had seized power, that the only thing which could be reached at the time of the workers taking power, when conditions were not yet right, was compromise based upon political strength and historical reality. In other words, using all of the organisation that you have and recognising the historical limitations to your own strength. And Martov argued in the Russia of 1917 that the workers coming to power had to take account of these limitations. Now, in the State and the Socialist Revolution, Martov goes into greater detail on this Marxist position. And once again, I want to quote from Martov.
It appears that Marx admitted the possibility of a political victory of the proletariat over the bourgeoisie at a point of historic development when the previously necessary conditions for a socialist revolution were not yet mature. But he stressed that such a victory would be transitory, and he predicted with the prescience of genius that a conquest of political power by the proletariat that is premature from the historic viewpoint would only be a point in the process of the bourgeois revolution itself. We conclude that, in the case of a notably premature conquest of power, Marx would consider it obligatory of the conscious elements of the proletariat to pursue a policy that takes into consideration the fact that such a conquest represents objectively only a point in the process of the bourgeois revolution itself, and will serve the latter by aiding its further development. He would expect a policy leading the proletariat to limit voluntarily the position and the solution of the revolutionary problems. For the proletariat can score a victory over the bourgeoisie, and not for the bourgeoisie, only when the march of history will have elaborated the material factors that create the necessity of putting an end to the bourgeois methods of production. The following words of Marx explain in what sense a passing victory of the proletariat can become a point in the process of the bourgeois revolution. By its bludgeon blows, the reign of terror cleansed the surface of France, as if by a miracle, of all the feudal ruins. With its timorous caution, the bourgeoisie would not have managed this task in several decades. Therefore, the bloody acts of the people merely served to level the root of the bourgeoisie. The reign of terror in France was the momentary domination of the democratic petty bourgeoisie and the proletariat over all the possessing classes, including the authentic bourgeoisie. Marx indicates very definitely that such a momentary domination cannot be the starting point of a socialist transformation unless the material factors rendering this transformation indispensable will have first been worked out.
Now, to continue on this theme of Martov, which is a very important one, in 1846, a year before he wrote the manifesto, Marx wrote a letter to the German utopian Weitling, stating that, quote, there could be no question now of realising communism in Germany. First, the capitalist class must come to power. And it's absolutely important that you see that Marx's non-utopianism consisted in the fact that these tremendous theoretical works explaining how socialism could be possible were at the same time accompanied by a recognition on his own part that in his own historical condition it was not possible. He was talking about the need for the development of historical conditions which would give rise to the possibilities he spoke of. Now, Martov in Russia argued that the job of developing capital must be carried out by a capitalist class. The alternative would be, and in fact was, for the workers to take power and to be forced by historical conditions to act as the political representatives of capital. Now, in his article entitled Critical Morality and Moralizing Criticism, Marx explicitly states that, I quote, if the proletariat overthrows the political domination of the capitalist class, its victory will only be a point in the process of the capitalist revolution itself, and will serve the cause of the latter by aiding its further development. In other words, Marx was saying, take power as a working class when the conditions are right for capitalism, and you will have to do the dirty work for the capitalist class. Now, Marx was right. And Martov was also right when he stated that the best course for the Russian working class was to let the small capitalist class, which was represented in the provisional government of February 1917 by Lvov and Kerensky, let them undertake the work of building up capital. Meanwhile, the organised workers could put pressure on them for whatever concessions are within reach. Trade union concessions, democratic opportunities, whatever they may be, while at the same time uniting with workers in other, perhaps more advanced countries, attempting to gain a worldwide movement which could actually bring about socialism. That's what needed to be done, and it is a fascinatingly prescient historical message. It applies to Islamic revolutions today, it applies to conditions in any area of Africa and Latin America where workers are being tempted to take control of capital, develop it, and take responsibility for it. Now, Martov rightly warned that if those calling themselves socialists took power in the absence of developed capitalism and mass socialist understanding, there would be two terrible consequences of this from a political point of view. First of all of the iniquitous government action associated with the accumulation of capital would be regarded as the errors of socialism. This is precisely what has happened in Russia in 1917 and, of course, after the late 1920s when the Stalinist economic policies came into full effect. Socialism was related in the popular mind with all of the state coercion, all of the oppression of the five-year plans, in exactly the same way as has happened in China, as happened in Albania and many areas of Eastern Europe, and it's happening now, of course, in Africa, in South Africa, in Zimbabwe, where strikes are being banned in the name of socialism and the development of capital. Now, secondly, Martov predicted that if socialists gave up their status as an opposition, if they gave up their right to stay outside of government and outside of the area of the control of capital, at a time when they had no other historical option than to be in opposition, then the democratic concessions which would be gained from a capitalist government would not be gained. And this is exactly what has occurred in Russia. The myth that the proletariat is in a position of dictatorship has logically precluded the possibility of the proletariat, as a class with real material needs, to oppose its own dictatorship, which, of course, is defending the real material needs of capital. And this has put not only the Bolshevik Party of Lenin right from the beginning, but the whole history of so-called socialist control over capitalist development in an impossible position. And Interestingly enough, that position is one which was predicted by Engels, writing many years before it even happened, predicted the possibility which would happen if socialists took control in a capitalist economy. And it's well worth hearing what Engels wrote on this in his preface to the Peasant War in Germany.
The worst thing that can befall the leader of an extremist party is to be compelled to take over the government at a time when the moment is not yet ripe for the rule of the class he represents. He finds himself necessarily in an insoluble political dilemma. What he can do is in conflict with his entire political attitudes, his principles, and the immediate interests of his party. What he is supposed to do cannot be done. He is compelled to represent not his party, his class, but the class for the rule of which the moment he happens to be right. For the sake of that moment, he must act in the interests of an alien class, and must feed his own class with phrases and promises, along with the assertion that the interests of that alien class are really their own. He who gets himself into that false position is irredeemably lost.
Well, that was written, of course, by Frederick Engels and not Michael Thor, although it could well apply to him very soon. Now, because like King Canute, Lenin deprecated Martov and the Mensheviks for having the audacity to claim that the impossible should not be attempted. If, of course, a small group of anarchists, let's say around here in King's Cross, was to propose to form an army and to seize control of Islington Town Hall and to establish socialism, and who knows, probably wilder plots have been hatched in this very room. If they were to claim that public feeling was on their side because the rates in Islington are very high, if they urged those of us present to join them in this attempt, and if we refused on the grounds that this adventure would not achieve socialism, and if those things happened and this little band of anarchists accused us of being anti-socialists simply because we have a clear idea of what is historically possible, well, then we would know what the Mensheviks felt like, because that's exactly what happened to them. They were told that by recognising the possibilities of history, they were letting down the cause of socialism. In fact, Martov's socialist principles, whilst not entirely those of the Socialist Party of Great Britain, and one wouldn't expect them to be in the Russia of 1917, were in many ways far advanced of Lenin's. At the beginning of the First World War, the Mensheviks in Russia split between the defensists, who supported the war, and the internationalists, who opposed it. Martov, who was abroad at the time, took the internationalist position and maintained this all through the war. This internationalism was not, of course, unrelated to Martov's long association with the Russian political revolutionary group called the Bundists. And the Bundists were Yiddish-speaking Marxists, mainly of Jewish, in fact, entirely of Jewish origin, whose particular political strength was in their outspoken hostility to the idea of national frontiers, which is a kind of hostility you would expect Yiddish-speaking Marxists of Jewish origin to have, because they were thrown out of one country and into another. And the whole idea of frontiers and armies and nations appalled them. And Martov had been intimately associated with the Bundists in his early political career. Now, in May 1917, Martov returned to Russia, a month after Lenin returned, and he unequivocally opposed the war. And in fact, he won over large sections of the Menshevik Party, particularly the branches in Moscow and Kharkov and the Donetsk Basin. And even though this left the majority of the Mensheviks, especially those in the factories in Petrograd, as defensists, it meant that the Menshevik Party was split. He knows who opposed the war, and those who, in one way or another, thought they should support it. Now, in late August 1917, many of the Menshevik internationalists, although not Martov himself, left the Menshevik Party, and they formed a new paper, a paper which was in fact edited for a short time by Maxim Gorky. Now, although Markov stayed within the Menshevik Party, he stopped writing for its official newspaper, the Rabotchaya Gazeta, and he only wrote for the paper which was edited by Gorky. In other words, he associated himself with an organisation outside of his own party which stood unequivocally against any side in the war. Now, unfortunately, the articles which were written by Markov are not generally available in English, but they are major statements of anti-militarism which are comparable probably only with those which were appearing at the same time in the Socialist Standard, which was of course the only journal in Britain to oppose the First World War quite unequivocally. Now, the victory of Lenin's Blanquism in October 1917 did not put an immediate stop to the Mensheviks in Russia. For 3 years, Martov attempted to organise a working class opposition against the Bolsheviks. But in 1920, he found it impossible to continue to be freely active in Russia because he was frequently being harassed and locked up, and he had to leave the country, never to return. And 1 year later, in 1921, the Menshevik Party was either totally fallen to pieces or else its main activists were rounded up and put into prison shortly after the Kronstadt revolt. One of the reasons for this, curiously enough, is because many of these activists who were not associated with Martov had, as early as 1918, advocated the idea of the new economic policy. And when Lenin did his U-turn and adopted the new economic policy in 1921, he had to lock up the Menshevik activists so that he wouldn't be associated with having stolen that policy. Now, Markov's prediction had, of course, come true. Here was the representative of what was called socialism acting with all of the rejection of democracy which is necessary for the efficient administration of capitalism. Now, in the summer of 1919, Martov drafted a manifesto. It was published under the not uninteresting title of What is to be Done, which caused a little bit of embarrassment to Lenin. And this put forward a number of demands, 6 demands, all of which the Bolsheviks would have supported before they came to power, all of which they had to reject after they came to power. Firstly, in Martov's What is to be Done, universal franchise and free ballots in all Soviet elections was demanded. Now, the Bolsheviks have been the main advocates of universal franchise for a constituent assembly before October 1917. After the revolution, they rejected it. They'd been rigging the ballots. And, of course, they had so centralised Soviet power that most people had no real influence over political decision-making. Secondly, the manifesto demanded freedom of speech and of the press for all working class parties in Russia. In November 1917, the Rabotchaya Gazeta was closed down, allegedly because it was inspiring riots in Siberia, although that wasn't very convincing to the Mensheviks. Curiously enough, it started up again the next day under a different title and remained in existence for 6 months without the Bolsheviks even knowing about it, which goes to show that the underdog can sometimes score a point. Thirdly, the manifesto of Martov called for the free elections to the revolutionary tribunals, which were being hacked by members of the Bolshevik Party, so that if anyone was sent to court on a political charge, the party which controlled the state was simply ensuring that they were sent to prison for a long period. The fourth demand of the manifesto was for the abolition of the dreaded Shedkar, which was a secret police force which had been set up by the Bolsheviks, and it was a forerunner, of course, of the KGB. Demand number five was to abolish the death penalty, which the Bolsheviks, like the Tories of today, vigorously defended because it was in favour of law and order, and you would have people rioting on the streets if you didn't kill a few of them occasionally. And finally, Martel's manifesto demanded that all state officials must be accountable to the Soviet, consisting of workers and peasants, and not simply to the Bolshevik Party. Now, every one of these demands was rejected. Interestingly enough, every one of these demands applied to the Paris Commune of 1871. So when Marx made his famous remark that, look at the Paris Commune, there you have the dictatorship of the proletariat, what he meant was, you have free elections, you have accountable delegates, you don't have a secret police force, you have people accountable to the commune and not to the party. Every one of these, in the so-called dictatorship of the proletariat of the Bolsheviks, did not exist. Not under Stalin, but under Lenin as early as 1919. So, Martov saw that it was not Lenin who defended the ideas of Marx, but it was in fact Lenin who, in rejecting democracy, declared himself and his ideology as an enemy of the socialist revolution. And the lesson to be learnt from this is not simply one about the pious superiority of democracy over dictatorship, although in experience there is a great deal to be said for democracy over dictatorship. The lesson to be learned is that historical conditions, the possibilities of the age, must at all times dictate what one's political strategy is going to be. Now let me conclude, not just this lecture, but the series of lectures, by making two points. Firstly, in speaking about the noble principles of 1871 in Paris and the cynical Blanquist tactics of 1917 in Petrograd, we should turn our attention to something much more recent, which I, at least, and here I'm not speaking officially on behalf of the Socialist Party, but on behalf of myself, I regard as the greatest working class spontaneous movement to have taken place in recent years, which were the events in Poland. Now, like the communards, our fellow workers in the Solidarity Trade Union in Poland were fueled by a passion for democracy. But their oppressors this time were neither a Tsarist autocracy, nor were they the old kings and queens or merchant governments of Europe. They were the direct descendants of the Bolshevik tradition. They were people with pictures of Lenin and, of course, of Marx hanging on their walls. Now, what can socialists say to those workers? What can we say not only to the workers in Poland, but to the workers who are being rounded up by the thousand for the most terrible tortures in the Ayatollah Khomeini's Iran, or in Iraq, or in Chile, or in El Salvador, or in South Africa? What can we say to them? Should we, as certain foolish dogmatists would like it, tell them that we are hostile to any attempt on their part to do anything unless they are carrying all three volumes of Karl Marx's Capital under their arm and are fully convinced socialists? Or should we urge them to undertake the political adventure of setting up a so-called socialist society there and then, without there being the material conditions, either in economic terms or in terms of political consciousness, for it to exist? That would be idealism of the Bolshevik variety, which would only lead to disaster. As we said at a meeting in this room at the time when Solidarity was going, to tell the members of Solidarity, 10 million of them, to rise up against the state and shoot the Politburo is very nice if you're sitting in a room in London, but it's a lot harder if you're sitting in a shipyard in Gdansk with secret policemen following you around. It's neither to the idealism of Lenin nor to the rigidity of dogmatism that we have to seek an answer. It's to historical materialism, as applied by Marx and as explained by Martov. And that has been the theme running through this whole series of talks. The role of socialists is not to say what should be done, like a Victorian nanny standing over the working class, but is to say what can be done from a working class point of view. What can be done? Now, what then can we conclude by saying in the broadest terms of the world working class can be done? We can be guided by the simple experience of our own activities and also by the pressures, which are always uncomfortable pressures, of political logic. Let me pose the question. How can we establish socialism without leaders and governments and vanguards? The answer is not to do away with leaders, to do away with followers. Well, how can you have a movement without followers? The answer, by having a movement where everyone knows where they're going. If everyone knows where they're going, there is no need to follow the one in front. But how do you establish such a movement? The answer to that, by spreading political knowledge, ideas. Well, that's easier said than done. But nobody wants to sit around in rooms forever discussing theory. So what are you going to do about that? The answer is no, not everyone does want to sit around in rooms forever discussing political theory. And that's why it is time to take our theory and our knowledge and to pass it on to other workers, not packaged up in books, but related to day-to-day working class experiences, so that people, where they live, where they work, wherever they go, are in touch with ideas which are not buried in the past, but related to the future. And when a majority of workers understand and want the new system of society, then and only then, there will be a revolution, the likes of which the world has never before seen.